we have a number of bills on our agenda. I'm going to start with Senate Bill 486. We're going to have a very brief public hearing, and we're going to talk just for a minute to Senator Corcoran about his intention for some amendments to that bill. So we'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 486. Senator Corcoran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 486 was originally intended to do what the Secure Rural Schools and Community Self-Determination Act tried to accomplish with getting the additional federal dollars to rural communities. That has proved impossible. So we're now on our third amendment, and it's not quite right yet.
Okay.
Because of the difficulty of trying to distribute the money on an ADM basis equally among the students in eligible counties. And I thought we had it with the dash three amendments, but I don't think we accomplished what we wanted. We still have the disparity between counties in terms of the federal cut formula. So what I'd like to do is either move it to the bottom of the agenda today or at least get it tapped in and get the amendments for the committee for our meeting next week.
Senator Corcoran, in deference to you, we'll move this agenda item to the end of the committee meeting today and, if necessary, hold it over until next week.
Okay.
Any questions on the issue? Seeing and hearing none. The only other thing that I want to do is make sure that we do distribute a copy of a letter from the entire Oregon congressional delegation, which has to do with their desire to clarify the intent of the language in House H.R. 2389 and Senate 1608. So I will go ahead and give that to staff and ask the staff to have that copied and distributed to members. So they may already have seen it a number of times, but I have the one that's actually signed by all the members. Anyway,
are you selling that or something?
No, way you're no, I'm just hoping if I copy that memo enough. Sorry.
I thought maybe you and Senator Corcoran have been talking with him one more time.
No.
But well, Senator Perioli and I decided to send that note over to the House to have him fix it. But
That's two.
That was just an anomaly.
So we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 486. We will keep it on our consent agenda, possibly for revisitation later today, but if not, then we'll revisit it next week. Thank you, Senator. We have on the agenda Senate Bill 935 relating to alcoholic beverages. We'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 935. We'll ask the appropriate staff person to come forward. Colleagues, this Mr. Yates will orient us to the purposes of the act, and then I'll make a presentation of amendments. And
morning, Mr. Chair. Dick Yates with Legislative Revenue. 935 deals with the Oregon Liquor Control Commission and the relationship that exists between the commission and the agents, the retail distributing agents. What we have is the original bill, 935. The committee has adopted the dash one and dash two amendments already. We went through the dash three amendments last time, and the chair then decided to request a dash four, which came through. And in reading over those, I was concerned about one section and talked with the drafter, and so we now have the dash fives, which essentially is the intent of what of the committee's deliberations last time. Did you want me to go through the dash fives?
If you don't mind, thank you.
Surely. Again, these are drafted as amendments to the original bill without the dash one and dash two amendments in it. And what you have in line 10 is establishing a rate of compensation for the 2001-2003 biennium at a rate of 8.8%. Now, the OLCC budget's already been approved at a rate below that, 8.54, I believe. So Ways and Means will have to deal with some budget adjustments for OLCC.
Senator.
Given that, does this, will this need to be referred to Ways and Means rather than the floor?
That's a good question. I think the contracts are already negotiated with the individual store operators and the agents. The changing those contracts would be by negotiation, and the rate of compensation is always expressed as a percentage, although it's an aggregated percentage. And I think what this does is it offers the opportunity for negotiation to proceed from this point for the agent. So I'm not really sure that there would be an identifiable revenue impact at this point, but we could refer this to Ways and Means and have them take a look at it, do a fiscal, and then re-refer it back to the committee, or we could have them move it to the floor from Ways and Means. Either way.
Mr. Chair, the bill comes to us with a subsequent to business, labor, and economic.
But that's a closed committee.
So oh.
Probably would want to do that.
My concern is only that I wouldn't want us to get crosswise if they have set one level in place and we set a different one in law. I think the intent of the chair in doing this is clear, but I think we need to make sure those are together.
Well, and there is a third option.
A third option.
The third option would be to change that conceptually to the rate that's already been agreed to in this legislative session, which would simply leave in place the idea that a rate would be statutorily set and then connected to the CPI, the index. Consumer Price Index. So any of those are possible, but let's go ahead and hear the rest of the amendments. I hope that answers your question.
Yes.
Thank you.
There is in the original bill in line 10 a blank in terms of how often the negotiating team is to meet. The amendments fill that in with a 3 so that the team would meet once every 3 years.
Would that be, is that lined up, Dick, so that, excuse me, Mr. Chair, is that lined up so that the team would meet before the legislature convened so that they would have a recommendation going into the budgeting process?
I don't believe it's specified in the bill, but,
That's the intention, Mr. Chairman, yes, that they meet in the off year between legislative sessions, and it's possibly every other year, but we also thought that they should be able to negotiate agreement that gets them through a full cycle, a biennium and a half, and 3 years.
It just seems like that. I like the negotiating process, but it seems like that, given the way we operate the budget, that has to happen so that that negotiation gets plugged into the governor's budget and the Ways and Means discussions.
I agree.
Beginning on line 12, it talks about the vote on the negotiating team must be conducted in a manner to provide representatives from stores operated in urban, suburban, and rural areas. The amendments add areas, insert, and to ensure representation of all geographical areas of the state. Then on page 2, you delete lines 1 through 7, which is the minor decoy operations. And then what's done in this bill is to also delete, or in this amendment, lines 11 through 13. And the reason for that is that you're later requiring that OLCC contract with the health division with regard to temperance.
And if I might just interject, the earlier issue of the conflict between the promotion of temperance and the retail sale of alcohol was pretty thoroughly discussed. The sticking point is that the state constitution requires the department to promote temperance, and that is not an assignable responsibility. However, it is a contractable assignability, so they or requirement, so that they could in fact contract with any agency of the state or any private entity for the promotion of temperance. And the thought in this bill would be that the following the model that we've been hearing discussed nationally with cigarettes and tobacco, the Health and Human Services Division may be the best place to promote temperance rather than the agency that provides retail liquor. So.
Okay, then in line 14 on page 2, you have section 5, which is renumbered to 3. And what you're amending there is ORS 471030 to restore in line 19 the language which again gives that responsibility to OLCC to promote temperance. And then you add an additional, below line 22, an additional subsection which says that the Oregon Liquor Control Commission shall enter into an agreement with the Health Division of the Department of Human Services for the performance of all duties of the commission relating to the promotion of temperance and the use of and consumption of alcoholic beverages. Again, following the discussion last meeting, the alcoholic beverages is broadened there. We were talking about distilled spirits, I believe, before. Now, you have a new section 3A in the amendments, and what this does essentially is to restore the section we just amended, 471030, to the current language as of January 1, 2004. So this is effectively a sunset on the change there that you're making with regard to these temperance responsibilities.
And that, of course, is intended to give the maximum amount of flexibility to the returning legislature to continue the actions through the Department of Health or to reassert that responsibility in the Oregon Liquor Control Commission.
Plus the information they'll have from the task force.
And the recommendations.
Then, let's see, in line 23, we're looking at line 39, page 2 of the bill, and just changing the wording there on promoting temperance to read, promote temperance in the use of consumption of alcoholic beverages on behalf of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission pursuant to the terms of the agreement under 471030. So in the first section, you're requiring the OLCC to make agreements with the Health Division, and then with respect to the Health Division, you're requiring that they promote temperance in accordance with those agreements. On the task force now, at the bottom of the page 2, line 45, you have currently 9 members. We're increasing that to 13 members and adding, and line 11 on page 3, adding a new section D. Let me get to the right place here. Where am I at? Right. We're looking at section 4A, which amends. Oh, that's the Health Division. All right. Section 4B, then again, I got behind myself, I guess. Section 4B again sunsets effectively the changes to the Health Division, so that you restore current language in January 1 of 2004. Changes again on page 3, line 3. You have, after Senate, you're inserting with one agent to represent large urban stores, one agent to represent medium suburban stores, and one agent to represent small rural stores. So again, this is the task force members that we're dealing with here. These are 3 agents who are selected by the President of the Senate, and you're sort of prescribing a requirement of that those members meet. They're selected by the Senate President, but they must be they must represent stores of different sizes.
If we also increase the number from a potential 11 to 13 and added one law enforcement representative.
Right. These changes begin on line 16 of page 3 of the amendments with E, a member to represent law enforcement, a member to represent agencies that provide drug and alcohol counseling services, and then from the dash one amendments, a representative of the Oregon Manufacturers of Distilled Liquor and a representative of out-of-state manufacturers of distilled liquor. And then in terms of the duties, it just adds in line 33, such other issues as the governor, the president of the Senate, or the speaker of the House of Representatives shall recommend, or as may be brought before the task force by the negotiating team provided for in section 2 of this section.
Now, just for the committee's information, we have met with Mr. Lazenby, who represents the governor's office, and discussed with him a couple of suggestions that the governor's staff had made, and that was one of them is to broaden the base of the numbers of people that would be on the advisory committee and include some other types of people besides agents and retailers and folks connected with the agency. So we did that. We added some drug and alcohol folks, and we added law enforcement folks. We asked for other feedback and changes. Have heard nothing negative from the governor's office about this. So we're assuming that any significant issues were left unresolved. Hopefully we would have heard by now. What I'd like to do is, I don't have the sign-up sheet for Senate Bill 935, but if there's any persons here present that would like to offer a brief testimony, we could open the hearing to invited testimony. If you'd like to come forward, please. There's two folks that have indicated. Yes.
My name's John Harold. I'm a liquor agent at Lincoln City, and I work for OLCC. And I just wanted to make a statement that in that one amendment, if that raising the base compensation from 8.54 to the 8.8 was going to cause a problem either with the revenue general fund or the possibility of this bill proceeding further, the agents would gladly give that up and just rather see this bill get into place so that we can look forward to the cost of living index for increases in the future and get the task force in place to review the whole situation. And we believe in that very strongly.
Questions? Oh, did you speak your name for the record, please?
Yes, I did.
You did, okay. Any questions for that? Okay. And that, in fact, may be, at this point in time, may be a wise thing to do, since my understanding from the co-chairs is that balancing the budget and the legislative session has been a challenge and a relatively ticklish matter of checks and balances and who has the checks and who has the balances. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, John Steubenvall, Communications Director for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. Good morning. Mr. Chair, just to clarify, having just received the -5 amendments, I believe as I read them, Section 6 in the -5 amendments repeals the task force effective January 1, 2004. Yet at the same time, the -5 amendments also call for the task force to meet once every three years. So I believe in effect the task force would meet one time and then be repealed. Is that correct?
Which task force?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, this would be Section 2 of the original bill.
I believe that speaks to the negotiating team, not the task force.
Not the task force. Okay. Sorry for the confusion there. And, Mr. Chair, one more clarifying question, if I might. Again, as I understand the -5 amendments, the contracting of the temperance function to the health division would be only for the 2001-03 biennium, at which point it would sunset January 1, 2004. Is that correct?
I understand.
Okay.
That.
Okay. If I might just point out one more thing, Mr. Chair and members, as I understand the conceptual amendment on the agent's compensation rate, 8.54%, which would be consistent with the legislatively adopted percentage from the Ways and Means Committee. given that the 8.54 as currently adopted is the aggregate dollar amount available for all agents' compensation, if each agent were to be, under the scheme, if each agent were to be given that exact amount, 8.54%, there would probably be some winners and some losers among the agents under that formula. In other words, because 8.54 currently is the aggregate amount, each agent is going to be, in effect, given some variation of that number. So if, under the conceptual amendment, each agent were to be given 8.54%, today some agents would get more, some agents would get less than they otherwise would get. And I think that's just an important distinction to put on the record at this point.
I appreciate the distinction. I think the intention of the drafter was that the percentage expressed be the aggregate percentage, that it not overturn any currently existing negotiated agreements between agents, that become the product of the work team, the product of the negotiating team, and the product of the advisory group that's convened. So I guess just to put that fact on the record, it's not intended that filling in the blank with a particular percentage require a minimum contract for each agent, but rather than it be expressed as an aggregate total, as we have heard 8.54 used and expressed as the aggregate total.
So the intent then, Mr. Chair, is that each agent also would be compensated at the rate of 8.54%?
No. It would be intended that the aggregate of the agency's compensation be increased to 8.8%, not that it require each and every contract to be compensated at 8.8%. In other words, we have heard an aggregate expressed.
Correct.
And we have used the aggregate in the same method to express a slight increase for the agent. Is that clear?
So the aggregate being the 8.8 or the 8.54?
Yes, I think we're talking about comparable numbers.
Okay.
The important thing is, do they think?
Yeah, I know. I'm trying to get this nailed. When you suggest 8.84% or
8.54%,
does every agent receive 8.5% of compensation?
Not exactly. The 8.54 comes from the Ways and Means and then the legislature as the aggregate amount.
I'm there. You have, I am assuming, administrative rules that allow you to apportion that among the agents.
Well, there is a formula for such agents' compensation.
Okay. The bill's silent on that issue. So if you just use the 8.8 aggregate and apply the same formula that's currently in place, then agents will see an increase in their compensation. And it would be reflected in their contract. Would that not be an assumption that you'd support?
Well, Mr. Chair, but I'm not sure how we get from 8.54 to the new 8.8 number without additional spending authority through the Ways and Means process.
That's why Blazing.
I think what we need to do is possibly deal with that issue in a creative and pragmatic way.
Send it to the House.
When we get to work session, we'll be happy to do that.
Are we in work? We're not in work session, but okay.
I did have a couple of questions.
Question away.
Well, this is. I just need some clarification, Mr. Steuben. The section where we're talking about directing the commission to contract with the health department to do temperance. Help me understand, what does that mean from OLC's perspective? What will you do differently, and what does that do to cost?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I'm not sure that I've seen a fiscal on this specific provision.
I assume your office will be preparing that fiscal.
OLCC has conducts a number of what could be termed temperance efforts that really range the gamut from a number of materials that we produce, engagements we do with community groups, young people, encouraging temperance, activities that occur in various alcohol server and clerk training programs that we run or certify, really a broad range of activities that I think broadly could be defined as temperance. I just, Senator, I apologize, but off the top of my head, one issue would be the requirements we have to administer Oregon's alcohol server education program, for example. We have a requirement under statute to administer that program. Significant pieces of that program talk about ensuring that people are not overserved alcohol, cutting off people who have had too much to drink. If that would be considered temperance, I'm not sure how we get there from a program that we're required to administer.
I could see how you might define that not as temperance activities, but more your regulatory function, helping your licensees comply with the law.
Okay.
That gets to the point of I'm just not sure what that means, but I suspect that between the time we deal with this and it goes to Ways and Means or wherever, that you'll probably figure that out.
I'm hoping. I guess the thing that I'm looking at is this. There's a temperance requirement, and I'm assuming that that's aimed at the general public. There's also a number of health issues completely unrelated to the topic of alcohol consumption that fits squarely in the purview of the Health and Human Services Division, and that has to do with lifestyle issues, the use of tobacco, and everything from those two very obvious issues to nutrition and even whether or not people buckle their seatbelts. It seems to me that if you're going to talk to people about alcohol consumption, there's a whole suite of other issues that are connected to addictive behaviors and lifestyles, including gambling. We've got all these organizations out there that are supposed to be, on one hand, promoting a healthy lifestyle. On the other hand, we depend on them for revenue streams. It seems to me we ought to get coordinated better than we are. But, and this is an attempt at least to try to put that concept before the legislature.
You want to put authority for that one in the hands of Ways and Means?
No. No. But I think it is an issue that bears discussion. And as the governor has pointed out, his initiative on possibly expanding the lottery will have a lot to do with funding counseling against addictive behavior. So it's not an altogether alien concept. Colleagues, I'm inclined to go to work session on this. We're in work session.
Mr. Chair, before a motion, the amendment speaks to Section 1, the negotiating team meeting once every 3 years. I would suggest to you, and since it's your bill, get your feedback, that you probably want that to be once every 2 years. If it's going to work, it strikes me that the negotiating team will need to meet in the even number of years so that they can provide recommendation to the governor in the preparation of his or her budget as well as the legislature as they start the process.
So what I'm hearing, and I think that's an excellent suggestion, Mr. Vice Chairman, would be once every 2 years in the even-numbered year.
Yes. And to make it easy, I would, if the chair would allow it, I would offer a conceptual amendment to the Dash fives, and I would move that on page one of the dash fives on line one, the percentage, which now states 8.8%, be adjusted to 8.54, the intent being to make that consistent with the budget that's been approved by Ways and Means already. And then on line three, the word three be changed to two. And the intent being that, and I don't think we need to do that, the negotiating team would be meeting in the even number of years, so they would be providing advice to, I guess it's to the commission, subsequently to the governor and legislature on what that percentage should be.
The motion is for a conceptual amendment on line one of dash five amendments to 8.54%. on line 3 to delete the word 3 and insert the word 2, the intent being that the even-numbered years be the points in which time that the advisory board meets. Questions on the conceptual amendment? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Vice Chair.
I would move the dash 5 amendments as amended to Senate Bill 935.
The Vice Chair has moved the dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 935. Any objections? Any questions? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered.
Do we want this to go to Ways and Means?
Actually, I think with 8.54, it can go to the floor.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Question.
I agree with the need to definitely address the compensation issue. It sounds like there's a real problem there. And I agree that we probably need to take a look at OLCC's function and the role of temperance as it relates to their duties. I am not comfortable with this. I feel like what we're doing is putting the cart before the horse. We have all these changes, and then we have a task force, and I feel like we should have the task force first and have them take a look at all of these things and then make some of these changes. So I think I'm going to be a no. I understand what we're trying to get here with, but I'm not comfortable with making all of these changes and then having a task force created. I think it would be great to have the task force first and then see what needs to be changed.
Senator Castillo, I understand your objection. I think the agents have been meeting among themselves and trying to communicate these changes to the agency for probably a decade now. There's been some resistance to change within the agency. I appreciate your objection. What I would like to do is point out that the only thing that this bill requires immediately is the promotion of temperance to be looked at through the Department of Health and Human Services. All of the other things are either setting up task force or setting up working groups.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is really the only substantive change there would be in this bill. So.
Okay. Well, I have a real concern about the temperance issue here, and anyway, I guess I'm just not prepared to see this significant change made. So.
I understand.
Okay.
Thank you. Other questions or objections? Let's call for the roll.
We have a motion yet.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, good point.
So what would you like to do, Mr. Chair?
Why don't we do the thing that can actually move the bill forward?
So where would you like it to go? To the floor or to the lady in?
I think we should go to Ways and Means.
You want to go to Ways and Means?
Yeah, I think so.
And Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 935 as amended to Ways and Means.
Colleagues, the motion is to move Senate Bill 935 to the Ways and Means Committee as amended. Are there any questions? No questions, I will call the roll.
Aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes. The Senate Bill 935 moves to the Ways and Means Committee, and then subsequently it would be
to the floor. And to the floor.
And to the floor. Thank you. We're closing the work session on Senate Bill 935. Let's move to House Bill 2033, and we'll ask the appropriate staff person to do a orientation to the bill and present the appropriate amendment. Good morning.
Good morning. Mr. Chairman and committee members, with House Bill 2033, A in growth, we heard this bill already, and what this bill does is it establishes an income tax credit or a corporate tax credit if the taxpayer is a corporation for the machinery and equipment and personal property that is used in farm processing. There are several conditions which are established in order to get the tax credit. The machinery and equipment must be located on land which is specially assessed for farm use or contiguous to land which is specially assessed for farm use. And also the machinery and equipment has to be used primarily for processing, and either of two conditions must be met by the farming operations. First of all, the farm operator has grown or raised at least 50% of the total volume of farm crops or livestock products processed with the machinery and equipment in three of the last five previous income tax years, or the farm operator has grown or raised at least one-tenth of the total volume of farm crop or livestock products processed with the machinery and equipment in the last three of five prior income tax years, and the farm operator uses the machinery and equipment to process at least 50% of the volume of the farm crop or livestock products raised or grown by the farm operation in three of the last 5 years. Now, we talked about the level of the amount of the tax credit and what your A6 amendment is doing. One thing is capping that amount of the credit per farmer at $5,000.
That's what that note meant.
And the other thing that your A6 does is it puts a sunset on this, so it applies only to income tax years before January 1st, 2008. So future legislatures can come back and look at this tax credit. By putting on this cap of $5,000, it is affecting some of the larger processors that in my database I have that are non-specially assessed land. So this does decrease your revenue impact slightly to $437,904 in the 2003 and $1.44 million in the 2003-05 biennium. This is just a slight reduction. It was $509,775 in the 2002-03 versus the $437,000. And the $1.44 is decreased from the $1.48 million in the 2003-05 biennium.
Questions of staff? Hearing none, this is posted for work session only. The chair will move the A6 amendments, House Bill 2033. Discussion?
I don't think procedurally you can move them. As the chair, I'll move them for you.
Well, that will work just fine. Senator Minnis moves the A6 amendments to 2033.
Yes.
Discussion? Any objections? The A6 amendments are adopted.
Bill to the floor of the Senate to do pass recommendation.
Senator Minnis moves House Bill 2033 as amended to the floor with a due pass. Any objections?
You can carry it, though.
Senator Farioli will carry.
Hey, looking like a utility commissioner.
All righty. 3 minutes closed. Okay, we are committee. We apparently need to rescind the subsequent referral to the closed committee on 9/35. So I am going to reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 9/35 and ask for a motion to suspend the rules. Suspend the rules.
So moved.
So moved. Is there any objection? We've suspended the rules. The motion to object.
You need to rescind the subsequent business paper.
Okay, I would ask for a motion to rescind the subsequent referral to the Committee on Business, Labor, and Economic Development.
Mr. Chair, I move that we suspend the rules for the purpose of considering removing a subsequent referral. On Senate Bill 9/35.
Welcome to the committee. We already did that.
I got to do it again.
We have a motion to rescind.
No, I'm going to object pretty soon.
Are there any objections?
No.
Motion passes, and we have done that, and now it's back to you.
And you can close the work session.
We get a couple more gavels. Until 9:35?
Get more gavels.
All of us.
Why does that, yeah, only one person gets a gavel.
And we're open in work session on Senate Bill 935, and we have to re-vote on Senate Bill 935.
We do?
Senator Castillo's vote will be recorded as a no. Call roll, please.
Aye.
You were tempted, weren't you?
I was.
Aye.
Get dirt for it, Senator.
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes. Senator Castillo's objection will be noted. Her vote will not be recorded. Yes, her vote will be recorded. Senator Castillo, would you like to vote again on 9:35?
What did we do?
We had to,
We improved it dramatically and Castillo, no.
Okay, how did you, what happened?
We improved it by removing the subsequent referral to a closed committee.
Oh. So what would you,
You want to
your vote is no.
So my vote is no.
Yeah. Castillo votes no.
Always here to help, Senator.
The work session really is closed.
Thank you.
You can just leave your proxies with,
We amended in a little contraception thing, but you don't care.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
That would be the temperance education. Senator Beyer, where are we on 2033? I believe I'm the carrier. I'm going to leave the room more now. The next on the agenda, I believe, is Senate Bill 2161. 2161 is the bill. B-4.
You could organize these for the convenience of staff, you know.
I think it's much more fun to create the...
Why should we be convenient to staff? It does nothing but confuse the hell out of us. Answer
me. Senator Perkin, are your amendments to 486 ready yet?
Speaking of confusion, they're being done as we speak.
Yeah.
Paper is hot.
Paper's hot. Mr. Yates, please.
Mr. Chair, Dick Yates, Legislative Revenue. 2161 deals with a reforestation tax credit, which exists in current law. The purpose is to encourage people to take land, which is forest land, but which is not really productively used for the growing of forests, and convert that to healthy, well-stocked stands. And currently the credit is offered in two packages, a preliminary credit when the planting is done, and then a final credit when the stand is free to grow. The total credit is currently limited to 30% of the costs of creating that stand, the planting, plus the management costs to get it to a free-to-grow state. In current law, the credit is sunsetted as of December 31, 2001. So the bill does two things. One, it extends that sunset out for 10 years to December 31st, 2011. And then secondly, it increases the amount of the credit from 30% to 50%.
Mr. Chair?
Question, Senator Corcoran.
In the revenue impact on this then, Dick, when they look at the $500,000 this biennium, 1.2 and then 1.4 in the subsequent biennia, how much of that is attributable to the increase in the tax credit, and how much is attributable to the the use of the program as it's been used?
To compare the numbers, I did a revenue impact on the original bill without the increase to 50%. The first year impact was $56,000 compared with $499,000. And then 292 compared with 1.257, and then $500,000 in 2003 compared with 1.4 million.
So the Mr. Chair, the increase dramatically impacts the revenue impact. Is that what you're saying? The 30 to 50% then has a very significant impact.
That's an emotionally loaded word, I guess. There's
well, tell me the numbers again. You went from what to 499?
That's about 900,000 in the out year there. And again, about the same in 2003, 2005. And that's about 440,000 in the current biennium.
Right, so it increases it tenfold in this biennium.
Right.
Okay. I'm going to be a no on this, Mr. Chair, unless we amend out the increase.
I'm not familiar with how the increase was established, arrived at. Perhaps we actually heard testimony on this bill earlier that the department favored a 30% tax credit and that it was increased in the committee. Mr. Vice Chair.
Was it increased in the committee, or was that in the governor's budget?
It was not in the governor's budget.
What was in the governor's budget? Just an extension of the years?
Correct.
And the department favored 30 as opposed to 50?
I think they did.
I think the department would be very pleased to have it increased to 50. They did not
oppose it.
They did not suggest it, but they accepted it very favorably.
Mr. Chair.
Question.
So the revenue impact, to help me be clear on this, Dick, does this relate to the 30% plus the additional 20% in the bill, or is this only relating to the increase from 30 to 20?
The impact you have before you, 2161A, is the impact of the bill. The bill does two things. It extends the sunset, and it also increases the amount of the credit. So the impact is the combined effect of those two changes.
Okay, so what would it be if it was 30%? The original bill. I don't know if I have a revenue impact statement from the original bill.
That's the numbers I was quoting earlier.
I'm just looking for the difference between the 20 and 30, the 50 and 30.
And I need to look at this for just a second here because the years are different on these two impact statements. And I think the comparable numbers, and I'll have to ask Senator Corcoran to think of that in terms of a change in what I said earlier, would be an increase in the 2001-2003 biennium from 292,000 to 499,000.
Okay.
And an increase in the 2005-07 biennium from $500,000 to $1.4 million. And I didn't have an 05-07 number for the earlier impact without the increase to 50%.
So it's about 100,000 or 200,000 difference in the current fiscal year, the coming fiscal year, in about 700,000 in the out biennium.
Correct.
Well, yeah, but I mean, you know, it's not that much if we had the money, but we're not funding damn programs now. Why would we increase the cut?
It makes sense to me.
Perhaps you could bring forward Mr. Rutledge.
This is the zero-sum game, you know?
Actually, I think reviewing testimony from the department, which they submitted with this earlier hearing, there's some significant benefits that mm-hmm. they're pointing out that would be gained from the increase in the tax credit. And although I understand Senator Corcoran's concern about the at-year effect, Mr. Rutledge, would you care to weigh in on the issue?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Wallace Rutledge, and I'm the Director of Forestry Assistance for the Department of Forestry. I would point out that there is a cap on the credit, and we're not changing that cap. And so it can only go so high regardless of whether it's 30% or 50%. So what we're really talking about is a difference in the amount of use of the program. And the committee, the House committee, increased the percentage in order to encourage more use of the program.
Good.
Mr. Chair.
Question, Mr. Vice Chair.
As I remember the testimony, Mr. Rutledge, the issue was really is that the 30% is proving to be insufficient to be an insufficient incentive to to move most of the properties into productive status if they're just lying fallow or weeds?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, that's correct. That was the reason that the committee increased the percentage was to encourage the more land to go into conversion. Right now, we're getting about 7,000 acres per biennial. There's about 1.5 million acres out there that needs to be converted. And so anything we could do to accelerate the rate at which we can convert these brush fields into healthy, productive forests, creates a whole lot of benefits from for the state in terms of quality of water, the timing of water release from the forest lands, riparian habitat, wildlife habitat, clean air by sequestering carbon, and all of these benefits. And so the committee felt that they really needed to do that, and in line with a cap meant that the total amount wouldn't exceed where it is today under the current law.
Further questions? Any none? Senator Corcoran, your objections get handled.
No. I mean, my objection's still the same. Zero sum game. We get screwed on it, you know, in terms of programs that we need to spend money on. So I don't see why we should, you know, create a bigger hole. I guess that's my problem with it. Small woodlands, great idea, but given tax breaks in this milieu, it's, kind of difficult.
Okay. Further questions? Mr. Vice Chairman?
I was just looking. It came out of committee in the House with no opposition.
And it passed the House floor with only 5 negative votes, looks like. My inclination is to go to work session and move this bill forward. I think it's an incentive program that clearly works. It needs to work better. Well, let's go to work session on this bill. So, open the work session.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Vice Chair.
Seems the winds are blowing the right way. I would move House Bill 2161A and goes to the floor with the due pass.
The motion is to move 2161A to the floor with the due pass recommendations. Any questions on the motion? Any objections to the motion? The clerk will call the roll.
Trustee Hill.
Aye.
Yeah.
Aye.
Aye. Other members are excused. The work session, the bill passes. The Senator Beyer will carry, and the work session is closed. So we go to the floor where they do pass recommendation. You have before us what's left here?
We've got 33.
No, and there's also 46, where I think the Senator Perkins checked for amendments.
2778.
We have 2778. Let's bring forward House Bill 2778. Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. Good morning.
Good morning.
Ms. Mahar, how are you this morning?
Pretty good.
Getting your exercise coming back. That's
right. Mr. Chairman and committee members, with House Bill 2778, we heard this already, and what it is doing is exempting the Federal Communications Commission licenses from property taxation for the wireless utilities. It applies to tax years beginning on or after July 1st, 2001. So basically, with this, the revenue impact is estimated for the local revenues is 8 million in the 2001-03 biennium and 5.5 million in the 2003-05
I am. And again, that we had some discussion about the FCC licenses and what portion of the licenses have been on the roll versus what they're coming on the roll at in 2001-02. So if there's any additional questions, I think the Department of Revenue has additional staff here if you have questions.
Okay, and why don't we pull up the Department of Revenue staff to see if there are any additional questions. 2778 is the bill.
Brought help this time, huh?
Yes, morning, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I was regrettably unable to answer all the questions last hearing. My name is John Phillips with the Department of Revenue, so I brought with me Eric Smith from our evaluation section that will be able to assist you.
Any questions for these gentlemen?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Vice Chair.
I think the discussion we had last time that we were unclear upon was the, obviously the licenses were bought at different rates, different prices, because of changing federal procedures. In terms of valuation, where are they at now?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, now being January 1, 2001, which is our assessment date, we have equalized the valuation of FCC licenses for wireless properties so that whether a license was acquired by a cellular company in an auction, rather in a lottery process, or whether it was purchased by a PCS company in an auction, those licenses are valued at their real market value.
Yeah. I'll give them a courtesy vote, but I'm not going to vote.
Thank you. Further questions?
Well, he needs more than that. Then. Well, I'll do it as a courtesy. That's fine.
Yeah. Are you? Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Are you in work session?
Not yet.
Not yet. No. I'm fine.
Okay. We're in work session on House Bill 2778.
Mr. Chair?
Hey, Charles. Here. All right. Charles, you're good on this bill, aren't you?
On who?
Just say yes. 2778.
Now,
another tax break.
I believe this is a piecemeal break. In terms of intangibles, but I think in terms of consistency and state policy, I thought there makes no sense to tax intangibles for 5 or 6% of businesses and not for the rest.
That's another good
this
tax
gets to a piece that the apparently the governor has agreed upon and is willing to sign, so I would move House Bill 2778 to the floor with a due pass.
The motion is to move House Bill 2778 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Are there questions on the motion?
Mr. Chair, I think I'm going to be voting no on this, just out of my concern for the concerns to the loss of revenue to local governments. I know in well, my part of the state, Lane County, is really strapped for money and has a very, very difficult budget. And so I think I'm going to, and they are opposed to this, so are the cities, and they're very concerned about the revenue. So I think I'm going to end up being a no on this one.
I'll do it. It's Chris.
Oh, come on, you weakling.
All right. Mena says I'm a no. Bring Dirkler down and tell him it was his fault.
Mr. Chair, with the Chair's permission, I would withdraw the motion.
Without objection, the motion is withdrawn and the work session is closed on House Bill 2778. We may be revisiting this issue. We have one before us that has several witnesses that like to testify, so let's go ahead and go to House Bill 3433. And we'll open a public hearing on 3433, and we will call forward Mr. Charles Kurtz, Josh Alpert, and Dave Fiskum.
Yeah. Now which one are we doing? 3433?
Yeah.
I'm looking at it. Just hear it.
Yes. Welcome.
Thank you.
Hello. Oh, absolutely. Just announce your name for the record and launch into it.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Ferrioli and members of the committee. My name is Charles Kurtz. I'm
a volunteer with AARP, and I'm here today testifying in support of House Bill 3433A. On behalf of AARP and its over 440,000 members in this state. It makes a lot of sense to us to use cigarette tax money to help fund health programs because smoking is still a major health problem. The costs associated with smoking have placed an enormous strain on public programs such as the Oregon Health Plan. And so, in a sense, we think a cigarette tax dedicated to health care is something of a user's fee. We're strongly urge you to extend the or to eliminate the sunset date on cigarette tax and add to the stability of funding to the Oregon Health Plan, which serves some of Oregon's most vulnerable citizens. To recognize, and you'll probably hear that cigarette taxes tend to be regressive because they take a higher percentage of income from lower income people. But we think the advantages far outweigh that concern. First of all, the relationship between smoking and health care costs is pretty clear, undisputed. Using these tobacco taxes to is going to help you balance the budget, take the strain off the general fund, and you'll be able to extend services that are vital to lots of Oregonians. And lastly, since tobacco substance or consumption is a discretionary activity, people can reduce their tax burden by reducing consumption. So we urge you to support this bill and ask you to move it out of committee today with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Seeing none. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Josh Alpert, and I'm here today representing OLOT, Oregon Health Leadership Against Tobacco, which is a coalition comprised of the American Heart Association, the American Lung Association, and the American Cancer Society. OLOT is in favor of eliminating the sunset on the 10-cent cigarette surtax, pretty much for the same reasons that Mr. Kurtz alluded to. It is, as it stands now, a simple bill with a simple purpose. Really, there are two reasons why we support getting rid of the sunset. One, it's evident at this time that both the health plan and the tobacco prevention program, which both receive money from these taxes, are needing this money and have relied on this money for several biennia. For us to come every session and start at ground zero to scramble and try and get this money back in into the budget is at this point seems to be a needless activity. There is a desire for this money to be going to these programs, and so OLOT, Heart, Lung, and Cancer is very supportive of that effort. We would, however, be very much opposed to any amendment to this bill that would weaken tobacco prevention. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Alpert. Any questions for Mr. Alpert? Hearing none, thank you very much. Yes, Mr. Patterson, Mr. Fiskin. Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Ed Patterson. I represent the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, which is all 62 of the acute care facilities in the state. When this issue was first adopted by the legislature back in 1993, during the 93 session, we were very supportive of it then, because the Oregon Health Plan was due to begin in 1994, and we'd had word that the waiver was about to come through. We were supportive in 1993 to adopt the 10-cent tax and dedicate 100% of this 10 cents per pack cigarette tax to the Oregon Health Plan, which the measure still does. We supported at that time the sunset because politically that was about the only way we were going to get the money to get the Oregon Health Plan off the ground. We came back in 95, 97, and 99 and again supported the extension of the cigarette tax, this particular 10-cent cigarette tax. And we now support the repeal of the sunset since this is the fourth time I've stepped before this committee and testified in favor of the 10 cents. We think it makes a lot of sense. The money is already the revenue from the 10 cents has already been earmarked in the budget for the Oregon Health Plan, as it should be. We think it makes a lot of sense to get rid of the sunset for once and for all. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Dave Fisk, I'm representing Providence Health System, the state's largest health system with facilities spread around the state. I wanted to join my voice with Ed's to advocate your approval or your passage of House Bill 3433. Providence Health System is a longtime supporter of the Oregon Health Plan. The money is critical to finance the health plan adequately as you make decisions on that in the remaining weeks of your session. So we're here to support House Bill 3433. In the form you see it before you at this time. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Scott Gallant. I'm with the Oregon Medical Association. The Medical Association was very involved in the passage of this bill when it first passed, and we, too, have supported its continuation over the years. I remember being beaten about the head and shoulders when it first was being proposed, and Mr. Patterson is absolutely correct. While we were arguing for a larger amount at that time, the agreement that we had to go with was a 10-cent tax. The opponents of the bill may have perceived it as a temporary proposal. Most certainly, as an advocate for the bill, that was certainly not our intent, but as a matter of practical politics, it's been a kind of biennial event. We don't believe that's really appropriate. The funds are, in fact, have been used for the health plan, continue to be used in this budget for the health plan, and we think it ought to be a permanent tax, and would also support the bill as it is written before you. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Question.
Well, one of the benefits of having this as a biennial exercise is we get to see a former Republican legislator proposing a tax. But the question that I had for you guys is, are any of you in favor of the Dash 3 amendments?
Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, I have not seen the Dash 3 amendments, so I'm not aware of what they do say.
Okay. Thank you.
Let's restate the question on the... Your testimony is that you support the removal of the sunset, and then you made reference to a permanent tax. And of course, we've had testimony in previous committee sessions that this is a temporary tax, and it reminded us, some of us at least, of the luxury tax on telephones that was instituted for the Spanish-American War, which was also a temporary tax. So, the question I think that Senator Corcoran was getting at is, given the good purposes of the bill and the biennial reconsideration of this bill, if it had a sunset provision reinstated, would you object to the bill? And I guess what I'm saying is kill the bill. Would you kill the bill if it had a sunset provision in it?
Senator Farioli, given your analogy of the Spanish-American War, which has long since been over with, if the Oregon Health Plan ceased to exist, we may consider it a temporary tax and consider rescinding the 10-cent per pack cigarette tax. But given the fact that the Oregon Health Plan is alive and well, depending on your viewpoint, given the fact that the budget is based on the 30-some million dollars this tax generates for this next biennium, given the fact that it's an exercise in futility because I think for at least this session, the governor has it in his budget. My understanding is the co-chairs have it in their budget. So the money is already expended, would create a huge hole in the budget if, for some reason, the sunset would stay on it. We would support that also, but think it's time for it to be repealed.
That was a qualified yes.
Mr. Chair, I would simply add that you as legislators always have the ability to review a tax without a forced review of a sunset. That's within your purview. In direct answer to your question, my one-word answer is no. This is too important, but we're advocates here for the bill in its current form as opposed to an amendment.
Understandable. I guess there are a couple of situations that I would offer to you that it may have changed. One is that we've heard significant testimony about tax avoidance in Oregon on cigarettes. And the director of the Department of Revenue, Elizabeth Harchenko, is working now with the Oregon State Police and the Department of Federal Department of Alcohol, Firearms, and Tobacco to
create a task force that will help collect what could be between $50 and $100 million worth of avoided taxes in Oregon. And so, although I agree that this revenue is earmarked, it's expected, it's contained both in the governor's and the co-chair's revenue projections and their budgets, I would argue that a recapture of some of those dollars with this new initiative from the Department of Revenue will impact the revenue significantly. Also, there's some real evidence that tax avoidance is occurring through mail order, 1-800 number orders, and internet orders on other tobacco products. And so I wonder if it isn't a perfectly reasonable thing to continue the biennial reconsideration of this tax, so, notwithstanding the good purposes to which it's being put. We're just in a very fluid situation right now with revenue, and it may in fact be that the revenue picture from this source will improve. And I think it's very reasonable to have the next legislature seated with this issue on their plate to reconsider it. So I'm glad to hear that you would not oppose the bill if it had the sunset provision extended to the next biennium.
Mr. Chairman, just so I could get this on the record, if I may, Scott Gallen with the Oregon Medical Association. I would encourage, at least on the House side, that the bill go to a conference committee for consideration of whether a conference would, in fact, continue the sunset. I think it's fair to say that appropriate tax collection is a good thing. Tax avoidance is unfortunate. It does happen. But I don't think it really is relevant to fundamental issue of the underlying bill. I remember these arguments in 1995, 1997. I remember them during the debate over the initiative to increase the tobacco tax, which was overwhelmingly, not overwhelmingly, but passed by the voters a number of years ago. It really isn't fundamentally relevant to the underlying bill.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, can I ask?
Question, sure. Senator Castillo.
On the Dash 3 amendments, I know a couple of you have added the noted words, the support the bill as is. So we have some Dash 3 amendments in front of us that deal with cigars. And I didn't know whether you were aware of are any of you aware of the Dash 3 amendments that deal with the taxation? I believe it's taxation on cigars and proposing some changes. Would you be supportive of that change to the bill?
Mr. Chairman, the tax on cigars, of course, was part of the initiative which was adopted by the voters of Oregon. And if the Dash 3 amendments modify that, I think it would be contrary to the vote of the Oregon public.
Mr. Chair, Senator Castillo, sorry, Scott. All I was going to say was that among my words were as is, and that was intentional, not knowing about the Dash 3 specifically, but suspecting that and one other. I think our support is for the bill on its face, and that's what we're advocating for. It would be speculation talking about what would happen if certain amendments are added. We'll look at it and see. But our preference, as I think we've stated, is the bill as it is before you.
Mr. Chair, Ed Patterson again. This bill, the 10 cent attack per pack tax, is totally 100% dedicated to the Oregon Health Plan, and the revenue was only on cigarettes, not on cigars or pipe tobacco or anything else. Measure 44, which the three of us were instrumental in getting on the ballot in 1996 and subsequently passed, did increase all tobacco taxes, including cigar and pipe. And I've heard some of the testimony in opposition to or in favor of reducing the impact on cigars in another committee of this body. And while my association hasn't taken any position on it, I think they have a very strong argument as it impacts the 30 cents a pack tax and the cigar tax that was passed by the board of 1996. But is should we would oppose using this vehicle and reducing cigar tax burden at the expense of the Oregon Health Plan revenue.
Thank you.
You know, I think you make an excellent argument, but I think there's a countervailing argument that needs to be weighed. And that is that taxes, as we've learned in our orientation to cigarette tax across the board, Oregon has one of the highest cigarette taxes in the region. I think we're up at 68 cents a pack. And in comparison with Idaho, I think they're up 28 cents a pack, or significantly lower. I don't know the exact numbers, but it's enough to incent at least $50 million in tax avoidance. And that's not the value of the cigarettes. That's the lost revenue. And those are not numbers that actually have been verified by the Department of Revenue. When we looked at that to begin with, at the orientation to the revenue streams, it was assumed that the tax avoidance might be $6 or $7 or even $10 million, seven of which might be recapturable with a very aggressive effort. The industry itself has provided information that shows tax avoidance is at least $50 million and maybe significantly higher. And I wonder if by having a percentage tax on high-value cigars, which can be $10, $20, if we're not just really incenting people to use the Internet and the 800 numbers to completely avoid those taxes in Oregon, and if we haven't just painted ourselves into a situation where the intention is to provide a reliable revenue stream for the Oregon Health Plan, and by making a percentage on a high-value item, what we've done is incented people to find alternate and illegal methods of importing those cigars to Oregon. So, I mean, I'd lay that before you because that's the issue before the committee.
May 17th.
Hey, Senator, if I just may respond to that, and while I suspect that there are ways to recapture some of those monies that are being lost because of black marketing cigarettes, but I also serve as a representative of my association on the Tobacco Use Reduction, Tobacco Reduction Advisory Committee. And the revenue projected for that is going up, and that is funded through 10% of the revenue raised through the Measure 44 effort. That's the prevention program. The revenue from that is going up. I don't know if the committee's aware of that or not, because the population goes up, and many more of the population apparently are buying cigarettes in Oregon than used to be. So the revenue is not going down generated from that tax going up. So I guess my point is that we're not seeing a loss in the money available to the Oregon Health Plan through previously approved voter and legislative approved actions.
Yeah, I think you're right in terms of that, raw dollars. You're not seeing a loss. But when the industry comes forward and says, if you have this much of a population gain, and we know that there's a certain percentage of that population that smokes, your revenue should be here, and there's a $50 million difference. You have to assume that, yes, even though the real numbers are increasing because of population growth, the real numbers in tax avoidance are increasing also. But, you know, I think what we're doing is arguing tax policy with healthcare professionals. Why don't we ask this Representative Witt to come forward? I think he's got...
yes, could we move this damn thing?
Oh, maybe not.
Work session. God.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, first of all, there's a document I'd like to get handed out to the committee.
Are you doing this for the car?
I don't want to hear this stuff.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm State Representative Bill Witt. The document that I'm having handed out right now is from the Department of Revenue. It's from Bob Alexander, who's the Tobacco Tax Program Manager, the Department of Revenue. And he shows the decline in cigarette tax revenues over a three-biennial period and it shows a decline from $371 million to $311 million to $275 million. So it's showing a decline of almost $100 million over that period of time. And if you look down to the second to the bottom paragraph, second sentence, it says some of this decrease is due to fewer people smoking, but we estimate that most of it is due to noncompliance. Of course, it was in 1996 that Oregon made a significant increase in its cigarette tax and in other tobacco taxes. And what we've seen is as that rate went up, revenue started to decline dramatically, to the point now that we have almost $100 million decline in revenue. And in the words of the Department of Revenue, most of it, they believe, is due to noncompliance. Mr. Chairman, I'm here today in support of the Dash 3 and the Dash 4 amendments. The Dash 3 amendments are the cigar language. In 1996, when the voters approved the increase in the tobacco taxes, it added it put in place a provision taxing other tobacco products, which includes cigars, at 65% of the wholesale value. If you think about that, Mr. Chairman, particularly in line with this report, this letter that I just passed out to the committee, the impact of that, I think, is pretty clear. The impact of that is it creates a huge incentive for people to buy these other tobacco products, particularly expensive tobacco products, from other states where they can avoid the tax. And indeed, that's what's been happening. There has been a huge surge in advertising for specifically more expensive cigars to buy them from other states to avoid Oregon's 65% tax rate. And you'll hear testimony from a number of cigar store merchants as to what has happened to their business since this tax went into effect. I think really at root, this is there's two issues here. One is there's a small business issue. The 65% tax, Mr. Chairman, is driving businesses out of business. It is severely hampering the operations that still exist, and there have been lots of people laid off. And in reality, we're selling much less of these products in Oregon through Oregon vendors. Now, some people will say, well, if we lower the tax, we're encouraging smoking. Mr. Chairman, I don't think that's true at all. What we're doing is we're giving vendors in Oregon an opportunity to sell these products where customers today are buying them from Virginia and North Carolina and other states that do not have that kind of a heavy tax. So I support the Dash 3 amendments both as rational tax policy but also as a small business issue. I also support the Dash 4 amendments because I think in restoring the sunset, the legislature can watch what happens to cigarette and tobacco tax revenues over time. And if this trend continues, I think we have to look at some other approach to taxing these products because it looks to me there's a huge amount of noncompliance that is going on. So I would support, and by the way, in the Dash 3 amendments, if they become part of the bill and the sunset is restored, we can also see what happens to the sale of cigars over that two-year period of time, and the next legislature would have to look in terms of the revenue impact from the bill as well. So for those reasons, Mr. Chairman, I support both the Dash 3 and the Dash 4 amendments to the bill.
Thank you, Representative Witt. Representative Witt, I appreciate the fact that you've been able to bring something from the Department of Revenue that helps at least document the potential $100 million avoidance in revenue, and that would be from a combination of cigarette tax avoidance and cigar tax avoidance. Colleagues, the Senate chambers have been reserved at 10 o'clock for a photograph session for the members of the Republican caucus, so we're going to close the public hearing. We're going to close the session off for today, and we'll reschedule this bill for next week.